Log Talk Radio.
Monday night, and that means it's time for the Constitution Hour. I'll be your host, Ron Golden, coming to you from PatriotFamilies.com. That's PatriotFamilies with a YS.com. You know, there's a lot going on today, even though it may not be in the news necessarily. Tonight, I've put together quite a few audio clips, and I put them together just to exemplify or enhance the things that I've been talking about and telling my audience for quite some time now. And I guess I should have not named or titled my program The Constitution Hour. Perhaps a more apt name for my program would be The Monetary Hour or The Final Hour, The Collapse Hour, anything and everything to do with money and our system. Now, Saturday, hey, FT, good to see you here, Miss Linda. Saturday, I was on Michael's show, The Hot Seat Left is Never Right. And we had an interesting caller call in right at the end of the program. And I've had just a brief amount of time to go through a little bit more of his philosophy, if you will. His name is Ted, and he really pitched himself as a philosopher. But I had some real concerns with Ted, because Ted had some affiliations with some very nasty groups and some very nasty people, or at least in my opinion, they're nasty. And in some of the clips I'm going to play you, you'll hear Miss Barnhart's opinion of some of these folks, and I think she nails it. People like Elizabeth Warren and George Soros and some of his groups. And, you know, this is really one of the dangers of the delusional ideology that's been pitched and preached and indoctrinated into people out there. When people in our society realize that something's not quite right and they just can't put their finger on what it is, we always look for a scapegoat. The Germans, of course, in Nazi Germany, looked to the Jews. The Jews were always the scapegoat. And honestly, if we look back through history, the Jews have been the scapegoat in many instances. And we must, I think, if we're going to be honest, we should take a look at those instances in history. I've tried to explain and tie together the reason that the Jews have been persecuted by and large. And it's pretty simple. If you just go read your scripture, I think it's self-explanatory. Nonetheless, I don't want to digress into racial tensions and racial wars, because we have far more important things to do. I just wanted to bring out that Mr. Ted, I'm still a bit suspect as to his legitimacy and whether or not he may even be paid opposition coming in to try and foment an uprising, if you will. He spoke a lot about the Second Amendment, and he had an axe to grind with large corporations. Walmart was one of the first. You know, that's the thing that kills me. Everyone loves to bash Walmart. Walmart has an amazing business model. And before we go off the deep end, just pointing the finger at corporations, much like the Occupy movement, you know, everyone, you go back and you remember the Occupy movement, right? Everyone wants to slay the corporations, but we have to understand economics, how an economy works, what the driving forces are behind an economy. After all, it's you and I, ladies and gentlemen, that are the economy. We are the economy. We are the ones that get up and go to work every day and work our tails off so that we can buy or trade, barter, if you will, our productive energies and time for goods and services that we desire. Not necessarily that we need. There are obvious needs that must be fulfilled for us to survive. But beyond needs, there is desires. And this is where we get the idea of greed. Anyone who wants to bash what they see as greed is no different than anyone that wants to bash specific lifestyles of consenting adults. I am in the same camp as Thomas Jefferson. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my bone. I don't give a doggone what others do, as long as they're not trying to force it on me. And that's really the idea of a free market. A free market is one that is free. There's no force involved. We're not forced to endure hours of commercial advertising and indoctrination. All of our electronic devices come equipped with a power button and a cord that's plugged into the wall. So at the very least, you can unplug the damned thing. If you don't like the message, if you are so weak-willed that you cannot deny or walk away from the enticements of advertising, then perhaps you shouldn't view or hear any advertising. Just unplug the box. It's pretty damned simple. I mean, it really is. Nonetheless, I've been talking to you for some time now about our monetary system, how it works, what the pitfalls are, and I want to share with you a few things because I think it will help, at least I hope, bring things into a more complete view or complete picture as to what's going on. Now, there's a few different ideologies out there, right, on what exactly is going on. Is it done on purpose, or is it something else? Is there an agenda? Are we being steered in one direction or another? So the first thing that I want to play, if I can find these clips, and bear with me because I'm really not terribly good at this, and there are a lot of clips to go through, and I want to make sure that I get the order correct. So the first one I'm going to play to you, you may not understand, has to do with the monetary system. It has to do with money and the current situation. So I'm going to play this for you first.
Organized groups of snipers shoot both peaceful protesters and police in Syria, triggering Western intervention. Here, groups of snipers, for no apparent reason, shoot both peaceful protesters and soldiers in Egypt. Unexplained snipers have sparked unrest in Thailand, Venezuela, and many of the other nations not under Washington's control. Also, Eric Drayton reported on the recent bloodshed in Egypt. Thanks a lot for joining us. Do we see the same thing in Syria?
That's correct. And again, if we examine the same situation in the early days of the Syria conflict, we have many reports from individuals on the ground talking about snipers stationed on the rooftops in cities such as Deraa, Hama, some of the early focal points of the protest movement. Remember that the conflict in Syria emerged out of a protest movement, but that protest movement was not a regime change movement. That was a protest movement and for economic reasons, fuel, oil, subsidies, perhaps some increased political voice, but it was certainly not a regime change scenario, and it certainly was not a violent civil war from the outset. However, what drove the conflict, what drove the violence in the conflict, were the presence of these snipers in the early days. So when you saw women and children being shot in the head in Deraa or in Hama, and they tried to immediately say that it was Assad's forces who were doing that, conveniently they never provided one piece of evidence to actually demonstrate that. And in fact, even the Arab League Observer mission in early 2012, which was openly hostile to the Assad regime, which was clearly an anti-Assad mission, even the Arab League Observer mission noted the fact that there was a quote-unquote a third force, a third element inside of Syria that was not the protest movement nor the government of Damascus, and it was some other element, and that element was driving the violence. And of course, as we see now, 2 years later, it was incredibly successful in fomenting civil war.
Yeah, why wouldn't forces within the country do this?
It doesn't seem to make sense that either side would really have benefited from this kind of chaos. We need to understand this in this broad narrative of those elements internationally which seek to use violence as a pretext for destabilization. This is no longer the 19th century imperialism that we learn about in history books. You can't just go around invading countries and you know, imposing your will by force and by violence. Rather, it has to be done in a more covert way. And one of the ways that you do that is by creating the necessary humanitarian cover.
Humanitarian cover is now official U.S. policy, revealed in the leaked new U.S. Army manual. Meant to be kept a secret document, the destruction notice reads, "Destroy by any method that will prevent disclosure." The Army manual was released in November 2010, just before snipers began appearing in Syria, designed to get round international outrage at direct invasions like Iraq. The new US Army manual instructs future country takeovers must be predominantly covert. The book lays out how to infiltrate ethnic and religious minorities to provoke civil war. Using snipers against peaceful protesters is an example. Work with guerrilla groups to make them respectable. Arming al-Qaeda and painting them as victims fits this category. Syria is being bombed, as the report advises. An insider has told RT NATO allies Turkey and Israel are bombing from across the border. In fact, the West has been plotting this invasion of Syria for years. France's ex-foreign minister.
2 years before the violence started, British officials told me they were planning the invasion of Syria.
The Syrian opposition deny these claims.
All right. Do you hear what that guy said right there at the end? 2 years, ladies and gentlemen, prior to the civil unrest in Syria, he was informed that we were going to attack Syria. You know, this sounds awfully familiar. In fact, I remember hearing a certain retired general speak about the same thing. I believe his name was General Wesley Clark. Let me play that clip for you.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the Joint Staff who used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No." He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq? Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do."
That is funny, right?
So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to al-Qaeda?" He said, no. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs," meaning the Secretary of Defense's office, "today." And he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran."
All right, ladies and gentlemen, so we're left with
the truth is about the Middle East is, had there been no oil there, it would be like Africa. Nobody is threatening to intervene in Africa. The problem is the opposite. We keep asking for people to intervene and stop it. And there's no question that the presence of petroleum throughout the region has sparked great power involvement. Whether that was the specific motivation for the coup or not, I can't tell you. But there was definitely, there's always been this attitude that somehow we could intervene and use force in the region.
Okay, so there's only a couple of conclusions that we can come to thus far. These people are crazy, and they're liars. Or there's a lot of reality based in what was just said. Now, remember General Wesley Clark, that interview was done prior to, ladies and gentlemen, our intervention in Libya, our intervention in Syria, our intervention in, where is it? Oh, yeah, Egypt. But we have to understand that the idea that Mr. Clark puts forth, that it's purely about oil, is naive. And it's naive for a couple of reasons that we'll cover later. But we hear the report from RT, and if you were paying attention and listening closely, and I understand it's difficult to follow all of this stuff because it does jump around quite a bit, and I suppose that's my gift. One of the gifts that I have is I'm able to follow things that jump all over the board because my mind jumps all over the place. As my wife would say, I'm ADD and OCD. I think she's wrong about that, but that's okay. What the gentleman was talking about in the clip from RT, one of the things that they spoke of were these unidentified snipers. You see, early on, before a conflict really arose, there was an uprising of the citizens, much like what we saw with the Arab Spring, and much like what we saw with the Occupy protests here in the United States, Linda, to answer part of your question about California and Idaho and some of the others. These unidentified snipers, even the Arabs, who were over there to observe as observers, right? Even though they were highly Mossad, or not Mossad, whatever the heck his name is, the Assad, not Mossad, that's the other side of the coin. Even though they were highly anti-Assad regime, they came out and said there seems to be a third-party force at work here. So even the Arabs are looking around and they're going, wait a minute, there seems to be a third faction here that we can't account for. And this is where the snipers come in. And the snipers are shooting people on both sides of the conflict. It's almost as if you wanted to send in a group of mercenaries or Blackwater guys, or XE as they're now called, to stir up a little civil unrest and a little violence. You start shooting protesters on both sides of the conflict. The protesters are emotional. And they don't recognize that it's not the opposition that's killing them. So both sides are out in the street, and both sides are getting shot in the head by snipers, and each side blames the other. And before you know it, you've got a civil war. And that's exactly what we have in Syria. But why would Syria be important? They don't seem to have a lot of oil. So what's going on in Syria that we should be doing this? Well, ladies and gentlemen, there's money to be made when it comes to war. And we've seen this time and again. Now, in that clip, the commentator also mentioned Venezuela. Now, I don't know how many of you have seen the news reports, and they're quite old, from Venezuela. You remember some time ago when Hugo Chavez was initially elected, and he was elected, duly elected by the people. I'm not taking sides, and I'm no fan of Hugo. But the money brokers, the power brokers within Venezuela, well, they didn't like that much because Hugo, you know, much like that pendulum I've spoken of before, the pendulum had swung to the far right with the money brokers and the power players in Venezuela, and the people elected Hugo Chavez, and what happened? That pendulum swung all the way over to the left. And where did that leave the elites, the people with money and power and influence in Venezuela? Well, it left them with their six or their butts hanging out in the wind, and a lynch mob ready to string him up, and rightfully so in many instances. Well, there came a conflict, and it was quite well orchestrated. There were a group of people when we tried to assassinate Chavez, and he shuttled himself back into the presidential palace in Venezuela, and it was promptly surrounded by people, average people, I suppose, in Venezuela. Down the road, some 150 yards away, was a gathering of the upper middle class folks who were being told that Chavez is going to destroy everything that you've worked your whole life for. He's an evil socialist dictator, which is probably true, but this was all fomented. And so these people gathered into a large crowd, and they were going to march to a local soccer stadium, whereby they would protest and voice their opposition. Well, the organizers didn't take them to the soccer stadium. They took them right down the street to confront the group that had collected in front of the presidential palace. So here you have these two opposing sides facing off in the middle of the street, yelling at one another. Presumably, a lot of expletives were flying, and with good reason, because both sides had been played, and they didn't even realize it. But they so hated the other side that they were ready to kill one another, and then shots began to ring out. And the shots were ringing out from a different direction, and people on both sides of the conflict were being targeted. These were snipers, ladies and gentlemen, who were shooting protesters on both the left and the right in the crowd. Well, they were smart enough to realize that the shots were coming from over that way. You know, they're facing north and south, and the shots are coming from the east. This is what has been going on for a very long time. I have tried to explain to everyone, you are being played. You are being played at a level that I don't think most of you can even comprehend. And they play on your weakness. They play on your emotion. Emotion is a weakness. It is not something that drives you to logical action. When we act emotionally, we lose. This is why I was calling out Mr. Ted, who was talking about our Second Amendment option being exercised. We're not there yet. And quite frankly, I don't know that we ever will be there. Your only Second Amendment option in my mind that is justifiable is protecting your family. And protecting your family from whatever invasion or intrusion may fall upon them. But we have to remember, and we cannot lose sight of the fact, that as things continue to devolve, some of the people that you may be inclined to target are your neighbors. And your neighbors are going to be guilty of only one thing, trying to provide for their families. The last thing in the world that I would ever want on my conscience or my judgment is that I shot a man or a woman who was simply trying to feed their children. I don't want that on my conscience. You know, I don't know how many of you remember the movie Demolition Man, you know, with Sylvester Stallone and Wesley Snipes. And Stallone is down in the underground, the underworld, eating a rat burger. And you got all these terrible miscreant people. They've had to go underground. They're just trying to survive. That's human nature. Our nature, our drive to survive and to continue our existence is innate. It's inherent. And it's also that same instinct that is being used against us by those who want to manipulate us. Now, I've posited on here my theory, and I will stand by it, that there are those people in this world that believe that they are rebuilding the ancient Babylon. They believe that they are rebuilding a perfect society. Does that sound familiar? Wasn't there a guy that was called Adolf Hitler that was building a perfect society, the perfect race, the Aryan nation? Isn't this what we talked about last week with the Jews seeing everyone that's not Jewish as Goyim or Goy? Okay, it's not exclusively a Jewish issue. What do we see? I mean, look at what's going on in the racial tension and division that's being stirred up around the Trayvon Martin case, among several other cases going on in this country right now. You are being pulled, pushed, prodded, and steered from every possible emotional angle that you can be manipulated from. Think about it. Your race, your religion, your gender, your sexual preference, your socioeconomic status. You see, morality is just an illusion at this point in our society. It shouldn't be. And we don't notice the grand wizard behind the scenes pulling the levers, just like in the movie or the book The Wizard of Oz. But make no mistake, you are being manipulated. Now, some of you may remember Anne Barnhart. If you don't remember Anne, I will refresh your memory. There was a collapse of a financial institution or a investment firm called MF Global that was run John Corzine. Anne Barnhart was absolutely furious, as she should have been, over what John Corzine was allowed to get away with. Miss Barnhart owned an investment company that she built from the ground up, and she was not in the business of investments to fleece her customers of their hard-earned money. I believe that Miss Barnhart is about as pure a soul in the monetary game as you will ever find. And she was absolutely furious when MF Global collapsed. And it collapsed because it was pilfering funds from customer accounts and using them to gamble with. And what she did was admirable. She came out publicly, announced she could no longer in good faith continue her business. Not because she was bankrupt, not because she lost a lot of money, but because the MF Global fiasco brought to the forefront for her, perhaps for the first time, made it absolutely real that your money, her clients' money, was not safe. She could not safeguard her clients and their money that they had entrusted to her for preservation and growth. And because of that, she decided, you know, if I can't help my clients, if I can't protect their assets, then there's no real reason for me to be involved at all. And so she announced that she was closing her firm and she would settle all the accounts of her clients And for those that didn't want to settle their accounts, she would see to it that they were properly transferred to another investment broker. And she gave them a warning. If you have your money in investments, get out now. Get your money out now. Take possession of your possessions, because if you don't, you will never see it. This is checkmate. And she was right. I've been telling you guys for I can't remember how long that if you are in reliance on the status quo system, you're in trouble. People have asked me for years, when is this going to happen? Well, why do people want to know when is this going to happen? Why do we want to know? When's it going to happen? We want a date, right? Like September 1st, 2013. Oh, okay. Why do people want to know that? Well, because they want to keep their money and their assets. They want to keep their possessions within the system until August 31st. And the night of August 31st, by golly, they'll pull it all out. And I'll show them. Fooled. Tricked you. And they won't get my stuff. Guess what? That's a pipe dream. As Miss Barnhart correctly points out, your money, do you have any? Do you have investments? Do you have a 401k? Do you have a bank account? That money only exists as zeros and ones in a computer. It's a digital entry. You remember back, way back, and several times we've talked about this. The amount of money in circulation in the United States, the M3, which is a composite of all the different currencies and all its different forms in the United States, the M1 and the M3, right? That's how we measure money, the quantity of money in our system. Less than, pay attention, less than one third of all the money that comprises our economy, less than one third actually exists. Less than a third actually exists in any physical form. That means that more than two thirds of all the money that comprises our entire economy doesn't exist. It's entries on a book somewhere. Remember Philo and I talking about book entries, right? And the majority of these book entries are done electronically with a keyboard and a computer. Ladies and gentlemen, over two-thirds of the entire monetary system is a myth. When you hear Ron Paul and others talk about creating money out of thin air, that's exactly what the hell they're talking about, guys. There is no tangible money to speak of. It's all just zeros and ones in a computer somewhere. And even that is not a terrible thing, right? I mean, in and of itself, it's not the end-all, be-all of an economy. It's really not. Does it have to be a tangible, physical thing that you can hold in your hand? Not necessarily, no. In fact, I would say not at all. But it does have to be something that you can count on, that you can rely on, something that will be there and maintain your time value. You've heard me talk about money is time. And Miss Barnhart agrees, and I'm glad she agrees, because that tells me that she's a sane woman. Not that there are a lot of those out there, but there are a few. That got me a really crusty look from wife number one, but that's okay. What we have to understand is deflation. So I'm going to play you a little clip about deflation.
Economists estimate a 1% decline in growth in developing countries pushes an additional 20 million people into poverty. And growth is expected to slow in developing countries at a greater rate than previously anticipated, from 6.4% to 4.5% because of financial turmoil worldwide. Already, the World Bank estimates high food and fuel prices have driven 100 million people into poverty.
The crisis is having a destructive effect on third world economies. The International Monetary Fund is warning that the economic downturn could create a widespread humanitarian crisis in the world's most vulnerable countries. The IMF has called on richer nations to raise $25 billion in the next 12 months. But if conditions get worse, the figure needed could rise to $140 billion. As the more developed nations tighten their purse strings, foreign investment is expected to fall by 20%. Money sent home by migrant workers is also likely to decline. There are concerns that social costs of failing economies could cause political unrest and even conflict. It's estimated that if conditions continue to get any worse, anything from 1.4 to 2.8 million children could die between now and 2015. The IMF Managing Director, Dominic Strauss-Kahn, revealed the organization's predictions this week and urged the body to stick to its old commitment. He said, after hitting first the advanced economies and then the emerging economies, a third wave from the global financial crisis is now hitting the world's poorest and most vulnerable countries. I urge donors to rise to the challenge and provide the financing needed to preserve these hard-won gains that many low-income countries have made over the past decade and prevent a humanitarian crisis.
So, you know, we're hearing this. We've heard a lot of terms over the years. Inflation, debasing currency, devaluation, it's all just a morass of words. And who really understands it, right? But if you've been following a guy that followed for a while, former Congressman Ron Paul, he talks about inflation. And in fact, I wish to God I had the clip, because I would play it for you. The absolute definition of inflation is not what many people think. We see prices going up and we say, oh, it's inflation. No, that's not true. Inflation is an increase in the overall supply of money. It's like making a pot of soup. So you got a pound of beef and 2 pounds of vegetables and 10 cups of water, and you're going to make soup for you and five friends. And five more friends show up, and they bring five friends, and pretty soon there's 35 people at the party, and you've only got enough soup for five people. Well, what do? You print more soup, right? You don't have any more meat. You don't have any more vegetables. So what you do have is water. So you pour more water in the pot, and you've got more soup. But the problem with that is that everyone there gets less and less nutrition from the soup. Why? Because there's fewer vegetables and fewer meat divided amongst a larger group of people. Same thing with money. As you inflate the money supply, you're creating more and more money, and you got fewer and fewer people. You put more and more water in the soup, you've watered it down to basically water, you know? That is, in essence, inflation. The result of that, everything in the economy costs more money. Why? Because money has become cheap. The cheaper money is, and I know that sounds kind of crazy, that money has a cost. But it does. Money has a cost. Whether it's paper money, or gold, or silver, diamonds, seashells, leaves, there's always a cost to money. There's a cost of production, and there is a cost to the overall economy for the amount of money injected into the system. So the more money you pump into the system, the cheaper money becomes. Think of that, the cost of money, think of the cost of money in terms of interest rates. 2%, 6%, 10%. Remember back during the Carter administration when we had 11, 12, 14% interest, the cost of money was quite high, and the American public did not like that at all. But we have to look at what portion of the public didn't like that. Well, primarily, it was the portion of the public that had very little money to begin with, and they needed money, and they weren't able to run on debt, which is what our government runs on, right? Government needs money. It just prints up some more, borrows it from the Fed. It's a complicated system, but it's not terribly complicated. What it creates is inflation. What we've seen recently is our interest rates at zero. The reality is our interest rates should be at 18% right now, today. We're not going to see that anytime soon. We're going to see worse. So we've inflated the money supply, the overall supply of money, and yet it's not enough. Why is it not enough? Because money still is difficult to come by. It's not easy to get, and wages are falling. Wages are falling. Employment is falling. It leads to a self-fulfilled death spiral, which is what I believe we're in. But I want to give you this little clip about the numbers, just a brief little snippet.
Spend for middle-class Americans who have found themselves losing ground economically. In fact, the middle class itself is shrinking. Our report tonight from NBC's John Yang.
The American middle class, the historic backbone of the U.S. economy, is struggling through a lost decade, losing ground and shrinking in numbers. That's the conclusion of a new report from the Pew Research Center, which found that in the past 10 years, family incomes at all levels have declined. The first time that's happened since the end of World War II.
There are fewer people in the middle now than there used to be, and they have a smaller share of a shrinking pie.
Not only did incomes fall, but so did median wealth, what people own minus what they owe. It went from about $130,000 in 2001 to around $93,000 in 2010. Who do middle-class Americans blame for this? In a survey, 62% said Congress, 54% faulted banks and financial institutions, 47% said big corporations.
Only 8% blame the middle class itself. So they see this as a problem being imposed upon them by large institutions.
Middle class Americans are also getting more pessimistic about the future. Only 43% say their children will have a better life than their own, down from 51% just 4 years ago. As people say, they're working harder and harder just to stay even. John Yang, NBC News, Chicago.
Now, isn't that encouraging, ladies and gentlemen? Isn't that an encouraging report? Now, remember, that report, that clip that I just played you, was from 2010. We hadn't had the news yet that Detroit was bankrupt. We hadn't had the Trayvon Martin trial. Hell, Trayvon Martin was still running around on two legs upright, just like the rest of us. Pay attention, guys. Pay attention. I know some of this is really hard to follow, and I didn't put a lot of time into putting this together. But if you don't understand the basic concepts of what's going on and how you're being manipulated, then you are never, ever, ever going to see the train that is coming at you straight down the tracks. And I'm telling you, it's not going to be pretty. Now, I put this together tonight because I wanted to do a follow-up on what I talked about the last 2 weeks. So I'm going to play another clip here from my dear sweet Miss Ann Barnhart talking about the inevitability of a financial collapse, and not just here in the United States, but globally. Listen to what Ann had to say.
All I'm doing is I am relaying to you objective reality, objective truth. who I am really doesn't make a whole lot of difference. If you all want to think of me as nothing more than the weather girl, then that's fine by me. I'm just communicating this information to you. All right, let's get started. The title of this presentation is The Economy is Going to Implode and You Deserve to Understand Why. Most people out there have absolutely no idea of what is going on in the financial markets, in the economy, and they especially do not understand the scope of what's going on in the financial sector and in the economy, and the fact that we have now passed critical mass and it can no longer be saved. What I want to get out in front of people is the very basic nitty-gritty in layman's terms of what's going on so that the average American out there can understand the.
Okay, did you hear what she said? Now, this isn't me telling you this. This is a third party, someone else, and someone who's a hell of a lot smarter than I am when it comes to the economy and how the system functions. She said, it's going to collapse. We've passed the point of no return. It is inevitable. It's a mathematical certainty. I want you to make sure that sinks into your mind. I've been telling you this for over 2 years now. There is no salvaging this system that we've been indoctrinated into, that we've been indoctrinated into becoming slaves to, this system. It's the only system we've ever known. It's the only thing that you and I have ever known, and most of what you've been told about how things really work is complete and utter horse hockey, okay? But I want you to hear it from someone other than just me, because, after all, I could just be totally nuts. Hell, Ann may be totally nuts. My wife is shaking her head in agreement. Well, she may have a point. I did marry her, after all. And that precipitated a one-finger salute. But I want you to understand why I've been telling you these things, and I'm not the only person trying to warn you. Now, this is another clip of Ann talking about money, and she's going to talk about a term that many of you have heard, but perhaps not fully understood, and it's called fiat.
The European Central Bank, they aren't even being coy about it anymore. They're not just printing euros, giving the euros to the banks, and then letting it trickle into the sovereign paper market through banks. He's not even being cute about it anymore. The European Central Bank is now buying euros and buying sovereign bonds from these European nations directly. I cannot even begin to tell you how bad that is. That is the incestuous and the fundamental catastrophic disorder with that is can't even be described, to have a central bank buying the sovereign paper directly. Okay,
that's
next square down,
doing.
Which I believe is purple. As Spain sells more and more bonds, which is issuing debt, the Spanish debt-to-GDP ratio rises. Okay, if you've got this nation that's a hot mess to start with, and they keep blowing their debt bubble, and their debt-to-GDP ratio just keeps going up and up and up, as the market looks at that sovereign nation, in this case Spain, what is the market's perception? Is that better or worse? It's worse. So if it's worse, what does that do to the interest rate? It pushes it up even more, okay? So you see it's this cannibalistic eating your own tail dynamic. The more debt you blow, the higher your interest rate goes, okay? Next step, turquoise, I believe. As Spain's debt to GDP rises, the economy weakens. We're blowing a big debt bubble. We're a hot mess. The economy weakens. The economy slows down. It goes into a recession. Unemployment rises. Next step down, I believe that box is red. As economy weakens, the Spanish government increases debt, calling it stimulus and welfare. Because remember, as the economy weakened, because of the increasing debt-to-GDP ratio, more people are going on welfare, and more people are demanding the government to do something. Well, what should the government do? Well, more stimulus, more stimulus, more stimulus. Well, wait a minute. That's just more new debt, which increases the debt to GDP ratio, which just makes the economy weaken even more. And it just keeps cycling and cycling and cycling. Next, the gold box. As Spain's economy weakens further, customers start defaulting on loans because people are losing their jobs. We're in a recession. Of course people are going to start defaulting on loans. Now, think back to what we just looked at on the Felswargo balance sheet, right? Amy defaulting on her HELOC. Michelle defaulting on her credit card. Secured loans, such as real estate, are booked as being worth far more than they actually are, and unsecured loans are unsalvageable.
Housing
the entire
bubble.
Banking system is revealed to be insolvent. Bank runs begin. This is going on. This is already happening in Greece, in Spain, and to some extent it's been happening in Italy as well. The poop is hitting the fan in the beginning phases in Europe, and that's what's coming here.
Wow.
Next, the green box. Systemic risk increases, thus raising interest rates in Spain. If there are bank runs going on and banks are failing left and right, what does that do to the interest rate market? Well, if I'm going to do this, if I'm going to give you my money, bank, I better be making a lot more than 0% on it in order to take on that risk. Interest rates and risk are positively correlated in a normal economic environment. As interest rates increase, Spain needs to borrow more money to service its sovereign debt and to bail out banks. Okay, not only do they have to borrow more money just to pay the interest on the debt that they already have. Does anybody here in the room remember that in the early 80s, coming off of Carter, when people would literally have to go and take out loans just to make the interest payment on another loan? Borrowing money just to make the interest payment? Yeah. And so blowing the debt bubble even more, and then it has to bail out the banks because the banks are failing, right? So what does Spain have to do? It has to borrow more money from the European Central Bank in order to bail out its banks. This just keeps going and going and feeding on itself and feeding on itself. They're not helping anything over in Europe. They're just making it worse and worse and worse. Why are they doing this? A, because they're a bunch of political whores who will do anything to maintain their position of power. Anything. Number two, a lot of them are imbeciles and do not understand even this simple logical progression. I cannot overemphasize this. Stupid people are running the world. Okay, this whole politically correct thing has been one big culture of let's elevate people who are stupid into positions of massive power to prove how morally superior we are. Guys, this has got to stop. Intelligent people have got to reassert their primacy in the arena of ideas and governance. Oh my gosh, I can't believe she just said that. That sounds so racist. I don't give a crap. Smart people should be running things. Stupid people should not. This isn't unchristian. This is truth. You have to get this through your minds. Oh, and by the way, when you encounter people that are criminal psychopaths who will steal and rape and pillage and will do it without any moral hesitancy or compunction whatsoever, there's a solution for that. It's called execution, after due process, trial, and conviction. We have to start executing these people because that is the only thing that they will ever understand, and that is the only way that it will ever, ever stop.
Wow. Execution. I would have to say that would be a permanent solution. I think Patrick would enjoy that. Maybe we could line them up and put their heads on pikes. But seriously, I understand why she's so aggravated and so upset. And I knew this would inevitably happen. that I've misnamed two of my clips, so I got one ahead of the other. That clip should have been played later. But nonetheless, she makes some very valid points. We are being run by stupid people. Would you disagree? Look at our current administration. Look at the administration prior to our current administration. But I have to ask, who is the stupid ones? Who are the stupid ones? The ones running the show or the ones allowing them to get away with it, ladies and gentlemen? Because quite truly, if those that are running the show are stupid, what does that make us for continuing to allow them to run the show? What is on the rung of intelligence, right? You've got intelligence, knowledge, wisdom. You've got ignorance, then stupidity. And then I think there's something, a rung below stupidity. And that must be where we're at because we're allowing this to happen in our name. How about retarded? Mentally retarded. We're not even capable. This goes back to the ideology of Plato's Republic, you see. And this is why that the stupid people believe that they are the smart ones. My God, Idiocracy, the movie, we're living it in real life. FT, you're wrong. Powerless is not where we're at. We have it within our power to say no. And that's the beauty of it. It really is the beauty of it, because in the clip that I wanted to play, that I didn't, or I'm going to play in a moment, she talks about what money is, whether it's fiat or not. All money is fiat, okay? Let it be. That's what fiat means in Latin. So all money is fiat. Time is money. You know, we've heard countless times that the U.S. dollar is backed up by the full faith and credit of the American people. What the hell does that mean exactly? Well, I'll give you the translation. As long as these dumbass retards are willing to get up and go to work for strips of paper that we hypothecate, we're in business. And our currency is sound. The moment that the American people, the moment that the sheep lose faith in that currency, the jig is up. And we're going to have to recreate ourselves into something new and fool them into a new fiat. And they'll all line up and say, let it be. But that's the truth. Time is money, ladies and gentlemen. Money is only a representation of your time. Yes, FT, that is absolutely correct. Education is the key. We have got, what have I been preaching since I've been on the radio? We have to change the way we think about money. We must change the way we see and perceive money. Money isn't something that's manufactured with value. Money is something that represents the value that's inherent in each and every human being in their ability to think and labor and produce goods and services. That's what it means to be a productive human being. You're producing something that is of value to others and to yourself. It is a mutually beneficial transaction. Doc is on here. Doc provides a service that is beneficial to his clients, his patients, right? They are in need of his services. And he, through money, is in need of their services, but not perhaps their particular service. Maybe Doc rides a bicycle, and he doesn't need an automotive mechanic to repair his car because he doesn't own one. I am an automotive mechanic, and I have a problem, and I need Doc's services. Well, I have nothing to offer Doc because Doc doesn't have an automobile. He rides a bicycle. we have money. Money is a way for Doc to utilize man hours, a portion of my time and productive energy repairing someone else's automobile in the form of money or currency, fiat. He can take that and exchange it for a new bicycle or repairs on his bicycle. You see, money is the thing that greases the wheels of an economy and society. Without it, we are totally trapped. And all, not all, but the majority of innovation is stifled or stymied. So money is like an oil or lubrication that allows the wheels of commerce and everyday life to roll forward with very little resistance. The problem we have is this hypothecated money. It's been bastardized to such a degree that it is actually destroying the very fabric of society. And people are in love with money. They chase after money. It's disgusting. And we lose sight of the importance of money. It's not the physical element of money, the piece of paper or the coin, right? It's the inherent value of our fellow man and his time, which, by the way, is finite because we all know that life is terminal. Life results in death. So none of us are here for eternity. We have a short window of time in which we can be productive and fulfill the needs of others. That is the whole idea of capitalism. Now, here's the clip that I meant to play, which talks about money and what it is.
The European Central Bank, they aren't even being coy about it anymore. They're not just printing euros, giving the euro.
Well, I'm going to have to stop that one because it's titled two different ways, and it's the same clip. And that really stinks because I really wanted to follow up the clip about let it be, what money is, fiat currency. Fiat in Latin simply means let it be. Well, capitalism is not, that's not true. Capitalism is a way to preserve your wealth. Capitalism is a way to preserve the time and energy that you have expended. And yes, to accumulate more capital. I agree. But you don't accumulate capital at the expense of all others. And that's where I believe some of the confusion comes into play. When you have the hypothecated monetary system that we operate under today, where money is essentially conjured up out of thin air, you have credits or money being created without any underlying productivity tied to it. Perfect example is the Federal Reserve currently is printing up and injecting into the system $85 billion a month in new capital. But it is hollow capital. It is 100% debt. It is not productive. It is not productive. And what I mean by not being productive is that the $85 billion a month that the Federal Reserve is pumping into the economy, we don't have a corresponding increase in housing of $85 billion or a corresponding increase in new automobiles of $85 billion. It's just not there. So it is empty capital. It's kind of like alcohol is empty calories. If the money that you're creating in your system does not carry with it the value of increased production, more cars, more goods, more services that provide value to others, then it is non-productive. Well, certainly, FT, I understand, and FT said not productive for some, but for others, they're living the good life. Well, that's true, but it is filling a void or attempting to fill a void. And what I mean by that is because the system is what it is, it's failing. We've reached critical mass, okay? And once you reach critical mass, the next thing that comes is a contraction. When you hear about a contraction in the economy or a correction in the market, that's what they're talking about. Capital flows out and production increases, and it reaches a point where there's not enough people, there's not enough demand, right, in the system to continue increased productivity. The system can't carry any more product. And it begins to collapse, and it begins to contract. And it contracts because you have too many dollars in the system circulating, chasing too few goods. And so it begins to contract. And one of the ways it contracts is prices rise. You know, you go to your Wendy's or Hardee's, and it's $8 for a cheeseburger meal, right? Where just a few years ago it was $5. You have more dollars chasing the same amount of goods because you haven't increased production because there's no one to sell it to. So there's all these dollars floating around out there chasing the same amount of product. They're empty dollars. It's inflation. It's an increase in the overall monetary supply, but not an increase in the overall goods being produced. Now, granted, some of the people that are on the gravy train, they get the benefit of those dollars pretty early on because, as we know, those dollars originate at the Fed. They trickle into the government. The government trickles those dollars out into the coffers of the people that are suffering. But why are they getting those dollars? Now, granted, there are some of those people out there who are getting those dollars because they're deadbeats, they're scumbags, and they want to work the system. But there's another group of people, and that group of people is growing exponentially as we speak. And that group of people is people that 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 6 years ago were gainfully employed, and they were helping push the car along the tracks, if you will. They were helping carry the load. But what happened? The system began to contract, and as it contracted, more and more people become unemployed. Well, we don't want disgruntled citizens out there because those people are likely to vote for the other guy. So we're going to give them a hand up. Not a handout, a hand up. Help them get back on their feet again. That's the stimulus, the welfare that she was talking about in the clip. So what do? We print more money and we send them food stamps and we send them welfare checks. But that's an empty economy. Those were people that were productive. They were producing goods and services within the economy. But because the economy is contracting and there's no one to purchase the goods and services that they were producing, they're now pulled out of the economy. Well, when those people were productive members of the economy, they were buying groceries. They were paying rent. They were paying insurance premiums. They were doing all the things that they're doing now. But they were doing it with money that they earned by productive means. Now they're doing the same thing. They're paying all those same bills. They're doing all those same things, but they're doing it with money that is not the result of their productive efforts. They're doing it with money that is being stolen from the productive efforts of those that are still left working. So now instead of 10 people pushing the car down the tracks, there's one. One person, where there used to be 5 or 10. It's wealth redistribution. You've heard that term a number of times, but it's accurate. It's absolutely accurate. Another way of saying it is robbing Peter to pay Paul. So you're robbing from the rich, and the rich are those that have jobs and can work and are productive. You're robbing from those people. And if it's not bad enough that you're robbing from those people, you're now going to rob from them even more. You're going to put a more onerous tax burden on top of them with Obamacare. And through Obamacare, you're going to tax what's left that you hadn't taxed already. This is what happened in the 1930s when they created Social Security. So not only do you have an income tax, but now you got a Social Security tax, which is taxing that portion that wasn't taxed under the income tax. Now we're going to add to that a health care tax. So you're taxed on income once for an income tax, the second time for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, now a third time for health care. When you hear about them talking about, you know, a dollar comes in the front door of the federal government, and by the time it gets out the back door, it's 48 cents, this is what they're talking about. And all of that money comes from production, working people, producing goods. But we're beyond that. There's no longer, folks, there has not been enough working people producing productive capital, so we've had to borrow money outside of the productive means, meaning above and beyond our gross domestic product. We've had to go outside the camp and borrow money from a neighboring tribe. And now we're borrowing more than we're producing. We're borrowing 4.5% more than we're able to produce every month. Every month. Imagine if you were able to increase your living costs every month, your bills, by 4.5% every month, but your wages stayed the same. Well, that's where we're at. That's what we're witnessing right now. And if only it were 4.5%, it might be salvageable, but it's nowhere near 4.5%. That's just the number on gross domestic product. And that's just the number that the Fed is pumping in month after month to give the illusion that we're in an economic recovery. You see, gross domestic product or production is the sum total of all the goods and services produced in the United States in a single year. $85 billion is 6.5% of our total gross domestic production in any given month. $85 billion, right, is 6.5% of our total monthly production. Now, the powers that be, and of course we know that they would never lie to us and tell us that things are better than they actually are. Right? They're telling us that our GDP right now is at 2% growth. So the government says our economy is growing by 2%. But if we simply look at the raw data numbers, we know that the Federal Reserve is pumping into the economy 6.5%. Well, now something isn't right. We got percent growth, but we're spending 6.5% of our gross domestic product every month trying to inflate the economy. So if we're inflating the economy by 6.5% and we're only showing 2% growth, that means, ladies and gentlemen, that we're actually in a recession and our economy is contracting by 4.5% month over month. It's not rocket science. And it ought to scare the hell out of everyone. And I'm telling you, when we sit and listen to all the data and the information, it can be quite overwhelming. But I'm telling you something. They have painted themselves into a corner. I've talked about this on previous programs. I knew in 2007, I knew for 100% certainty that we were at our Rubicon. We had crossed our Rubicon. I know now that we crossed our Rubicon long before 2007. It just wasn't apparent, or at least it wasn't apparent to me. I was still pretty damned naive. But it is painfully apparent now that we have far surpassed our Rubicon. For those of you that don't know, the Rubicon is a point of no return, meaning there is no going back. It's too late. It's cast in stone. The wheels have been set in motion. And there isn't a doggone thing you can do to alter the course of where we're headed right now. What we can do is be smart, logical, and rational about what to do once the dust begins to settle after our imminent collision with the brick wall that we are fast approaching. And that's where we have to keep our wits about us. We cannot allow ourselves to descend into emotional reactionism. We cannot follow the idiots out there that want to foment taking up arms against your government and everybody else. Look, there's plenty of blame to go around, folks. There's a lot of folks out there to blame. But before we start blaming everyone else, we need to take a good, long, hard look in the mirror. Because while we may not have known, and we may have been deceived, we should have known. We should not have been deceived. We should have been steadfast in our resolve. We should not have allowed things to descend to the point that they are today. And standing around pointing the finger of blame at everybody else and trying to pick up a ball bat and go out and smack everyone in the head that's an idiot, it's too late for that. That's something that should have been done 50, 60 years ago, not today. It's too damn late. It's far too damn late. So what you better be paying attention to, what you better be focusing your time, efforts, and energy on is preserving and protecting what little you have remaining. Family and whatever possession you think you can hold on to. And I'm going to bring in Miss Linda from California. Miss Linda, how are you?
Fine. How are you doing? I'm getting better. I just feel a little tired today, but taking stupid medicine. Anyway, I saw that Barnhart video, of course, earlier on today, and then I was pretty in depth in the monetary stuff with the creature from Jekyll Island, which is pretty much a wealth of information on the Federal Reserve System, Bank of England, the history of money, you know, BC, et cetera, flipping coins, all of it. Going way back.
Absolutely.
So what I got out of it was, at this point, because I'm not even quite to the halfway point, but that if we had an honest monetary system, which we do not, and the government was limited to its original, and I mean way back, original intent of just coining money and weights and measures, we'd be fine. But no, they have to get their hands in it, and somebody's got to be evil, and they want to have a world order, so that's where we're at.
Well, exactly.
I know the game.
That's where me and Ann Barnhart part company, because she's satisfied with justifying all that's happened simply by saying because the world is run by stupid people. Well, I'm sorry, but that's bullshit. They're not stupid. Now,
no, we are.
the physical, managers, the leaders that they put up in front of everybody, well, they may well be pretty damn stupid. I think they are. They're used as pawns. But are they any more a pawn? Is Obama any more a pawn than you or I or some poor bastard that's sent over to Afghanistan or Syria or Libya or anywhere else to die?
Yep. Yep.
No.
And
I mean, they're equally pawns. There is something more sinister and more despicable behind this. And that's where her and I part ways. you know, the whole idea behind the gold standard, I understand why so many people, Ron Paul and many others, want a gold standard. I've said many times, it does not matter, ladies and gentlemen, what medium of exchange you use. I don't care. Use peanut shells for all I give a damn. It will descend into exactly the same thing that
right.
we have now. Gold has descended into that, silver, all of it. It's all been bastardized. They find
right.
a way to cheat, lie, steal.
Sure.
And that is where she's
right.
exactly correct. The very moment that the appearance of impropriety raises its ugly head in the banking
mm-hmm.
sector, that person should be tried, and if convicted, they should be executed. I agree with her 100%.
I do, too. You know,
it cannot
I mean,
be tolerated.
When you're talking about the clamshells or the peanut shells, I mean, wasn't it in ancient times in England where they had tally sticks and
yep.
whatever they were doing was working fine and nobody was complaining? I mean,
yeah,
you can look at periods.
The fractional reserve lending and interest in and of itself is not a bad thing. What has to be is there has to be absolute cast in stone rules. And
right.
I still have an issue personally with fractional reserve lending. I think it should be a 100% reserve requirement. Why? Because that is a 100% honest monetary system.
Sure.
If some creator like a Steve Jobs comes along and he's got such an amazing concept or idea, I promise you that there will be plenty of smart people out there who are willing to take a risk with a portion
uh-huh.
of their money to fund
venture
or capitalize
capital.
Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
So you don't have to hypothecate new money on a
right.
book entry
yeah, absolutely.
That creates credit out of thin air to fund this crap. Right. That to me is the slippery slope. And you're absolutely right. When you go back and look at Congress's authority, their mandate for money.
Right.
They were not nowhere. I challenge anyone to find in that Constitution where Congress was given a mandate to set the value of the currency.
Nope.
A mark to market, if you will. Right? Non-existent.
Yep.
The only place it exists is to regulate the value of foreign currency.
Yep.
Now, why would that be important, to regulate the value of foreign currency? Not your currency, not yours, but foreign currency. I just read an article 2 days ago, and I personally think it's far too late for this to occur. I think the horse is out of the barn and it's just tough tits. But
mm-hmm.
the gentleman that wrote the article was talking about China and China being in a position right now to actually curtail our Federal Reserve Bank. And I believe they are in a position to do this. And what he suggested was that China pass a law creating a floor, a basis for gold
mm-hmm.
in dollars, in U.S. dollars.
Wow.
Now, how does that work? Well, China is in possession of 3+ trillion U.S. dollars. So China says, okay, we pass a law, and they say, the government will pay to you 1,500 U.S. dollars for every ounce of gold that you bring to us. You notice something different there. The gold is not being valued in dollars. The dollar is being valued in gold.
Oh.
And as part of the law, the floor, the level at which they will pay, can never be adjusted downward. So they can't drop it to 1,300 or 1,200. They can't
wow.
diminish the value of gold by increasing the value of the dollar by lowering how many they're going to give you. No, the only way that they can adjust it would be to adjust it upward to compensate for what? The devaluation of the frickin' dollar. Can you imagine the impact? Okay, not here at home. other countries, other citizens would say, China, that's a great deal. And there would be a flood of gold into China and a flood of dollars going out the door.
Oh, my gosh.
Until they could find equilibrium, whatever that may be. $2,000 an ounce, $5,000, $7,000.
Oh, my God.
Who knows? But you see, it would force our government to pull in the reins and to try and stop the hemorrhaging that is U.S. dollars bleeding into the system, because it would pull the sheets off the bed and everyone could see that the emperor was naked. The naker was emperor. They could see that the emperor had no clothes. And it would be game, set, and match. But I think, personally, I think it would just precipitate the collapse that much faster. I don't believe there's a damn thing they can do to change it at this point. I don't think they can alter it one bit. They can fiddle around the edges, but it ain't happening.
It's pretty scary. And you're right.
Conclusion.
I mean, what you're correct about is all of the, like the price of silver and gold, and you talked about the ratios of that. And the fact that the more I see of this, the more I'm thinking, why do I still have my money in that bank? I've got to start pulling it out.
You've got to be freaking insane, folks. And I'm going to tell you right now, and I talked about this last time, and I didn't mean to cut you off, Linda, but, you know, Mr. Michael Magic, I'm going to give him all the credit, because he's been saying it for over a year. If you've got your money in a bank, get it the hell out. You're crazy. You've got to be absolutely stark-raving, lunatic, mad nuts. Unless you don't value your time and your productive effort.
Right.
If your time and your effort means absolutely nothing to you and life is just easy, hey, don't worry about it. Leave your money in the damn bank. Remain a slave to the system, because that's what you are, whether you realize it or not. And that's one of the things Anne talked about in her video. She said, how much of your wealth, your retirement, how much of that do you have where you can right now get up out of your chair,
access,
walk over, and lay your hands on it right now, not tomorrow, not 30 minutes from now, not an hour from now, right now, how much of your accumulated wealth can you lay your fingers on immediately? Because that's what you have. Anything that you can't touch right now.
You
ain't got, because it doesn't exist. What do you mean it doesn't exist? I talked about it at the top of the show. Over 2/3 of all the money in our economy is electronic. It exists only as a booking entry, and we all remember Enron and how accurate they were with their book and accounting methods, right? So if you don't have it in your physical possession, you don't have it.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's why people don't buy paper gold. Yeah.
Yep. I'm telling you, if you've got money in the bank, in the stock market, in a 401k, I don't care. If you've got money anywhere other than in your pocket or in under your mattress or wherever the hell it might be where you can get to it immediately without going through some middleman, get it. Get it. Close your account. I'm telling you, pull that money out. Have it in your physical possession. Convert it into something usable, whether it's ammunition, whether it's storable food, whether it's guns or gold, silver. I don't care what you convert it into. Convert it into a commodity that has value, because I'm telling you right now that your money is going to be short-lived, folks. And if you think that you can run down to the bank and close your account, you're going to be sadly disappointed.
Yeah.
Very short order.
I don't even think they let you do it now in California. They'll hand you a check, like a cashier's check, but try to cash it. Yeah, they won't give you the cash.
What have we talked about on the show? Banks don't lend money, but they will give you a check.
They don't have enough currency on
hand.
They know that.
There you go. They don't have the money. Let's draw back and let's think about that comment again. Over 2/3 of all the money in the system doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay? So imagine, if you will, that 1/3 of the population of the United States went to the bank tomorrow to close their account. What would happen? It's over.
Hitting the fan.
It is flipping over because they don't have it.
I know. Oh, my God.
Oh, well, give us the time. Hey, you know, I went and pulled money out of my account, and they didn't have enough to cash the check that I had.
Oh, my God.
And they said, well, we can order the money from the Federal Reserve Bank in Atlanta. Said,
oh,
great.
My God.
Well, in 2 days, we'll have the money. Oh, in 2 days, you'll have my money. But it's mine.
Wow.
Why don't you have it now? You see.
Oh, man.
And, I mean, we're not talking $1 billion or even $1 million or even $100,000. Nowhere near that.
I know.
And right now you have a zero reserve requirement. Zero.
Oh, my God.
Now,
yeah, I know. It's heinous what they're doing.
Some of the numbers that Ms. Barnhart goes over in that video is a little bit dated, but not that old.
Yeah.
Okay. According to the accounting offices, the amount of money on deposit at U.S. banks is somewhere between $8 and $10 trillion. That sounds like a lot of money. $8 to $10 trillion, that sounds like a lot of money, and it is. But what we're not understanding is the bigger picture of what that represents. If, ladies and gentlemen, we had a 10% reserve requirement, which we don't, but we used to have,
mm-hmm.
if we had a 10% reserve requirement, the money on deposit at the banks standing at $10 trillion would represent the 10% reserve, meaning that 90% of the money was not on deposit at the bank. So when they say there's $10 trillion on deposit at U.S. banks total, that is a percentage of the total monetary supply. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That $10 trillion represents, we'll say for the sake of argument, the 10% reserve requirement.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So the banks have 10% on hand.
Jeez.
We know a couple of things, right? That the proverbial printing presses are running white ass open.
Like Weimar, yeah.
not only just the electronic ones where they're adding digits electronically on a keyboard, but also the actual physical printing presses
where
they're printing currency. They're running white ass open. And we, $10 trillion represents 10% of the liabilities of those
mm-hmm.
very same banks. Meaning what they have on hand in cash at each bank represents about 10% of what they actually owe to their depositors should their depositors want to come and close their accounts. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to look at 10, the number 10, and then look at the M3, which, by the way, the Federal Reserve no longer publishes. They haven't published that since March of 2007. I wonder why. Because it would probably allow you to understand that the overall money supply far outstrips 90%, $10 trillion. It's probably more in the order of 140% of $10
trillion. Mm.
Remembering that only a third of that or less exists in cash form, there is no way in hell, no way possible that they could get you your money in a year.
Right. Wow.
And if only 25% of account holders in the U.S. closed their account, the system would be blown apart.
Yep. That would not be good.
10%. No. It is completely, it's out of control. It's been out of control. There is
no
turning
back.
Yeah. The brakes are gone. The wheels have come off. We're running on the axles. We're digging a trough like the Marianas Trench across the face of the globe. and it's not just us. It's not just the United States. If it were only just the United States, there would be some hope. But it's not. Did you read the article? I read it today. That still, right now, the Federal Reserve is bailing out national or foreign banks to the tune of $33 trillion.
God.
Where do you think this money is coming from?
It comes from the taxpayers.
It comes from thin air. It's It's the Mandrake mechanism. The Fed doesn't have $33 trillion. Our federal government does not have the ability, the collateral, the human resources. We are the human resources.
Yeah.
We are the full faith and credit of that money. That represents the entire production of the United States for the next three years. Are you freaking kidding me? We're in hock for a complete year plus at $17 trillion. We're in hock for a totally one complete year, one complete fiscal calendar year of production, all that production, the whole of the United States, for one year, and you still come up short of paying the debt, okay? And now we're going to go $33 trillion. That's going another 3.5-4 years into the future, and we haven't even begun to talk about our derivatives and our unfunded liabilities through Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and now, of course, Obamacare.
It's sick.
Now we're talking in $100-plus trillion. You're going 10-plus years into the future without a single shred of any kind of growth at all.
No.
It's
getting worse, too.
At its current level. It's going to be worse.
And that's the worst part about it, because everything that's been implemented in the last 5 years has made it exponentially worse, because look at what these poor employers are doing. They're firing people, they're laying them off, they're cutting their hours because they don't want to deal with this Obamacare, which got shoved down everybody's throats. And
why are they doing that?
80%
you're talking about these evil corporations. Why would they do that, Linda? Because they're trying to preserve what little wealth they have left.
Yeah,
now,
I agree.
We hear all these reports about, oh, these businesses are all flush with cash. Well, that's because they don't know what the hell to do with it, right? I mean, you're a big corporation, you're ExxonMobil or somebody like that, you've got, I don't know, let's say $4 billion in cash sitting on your books just because you don't know what the hell to do with it, and you're not about to take a step one direction and be wrong, because if you're wrong, it could wipe out your entire business with one wrong decision, and there's so much uncertainty in the market, so we can't just point the finger of blame at all these big corporations. Why do these big corporations exist in the first place? That's something else we ought to be looking at. Well, there we go. We got to go in the bathroom and look in that damn mirror again, because they were simply providing something that we asked for, whether we realize we asked for it or not. They're filling a market need. If there was no need in the marketplace, they wouldn't be in business.
Right. That's true.
Period.
So when companies,
and I want to rip their head
off. I know. When they steal the taxpayers' money, which I call it theft, I don't care what they can call anything they want. But, when they steal that money and it gets paid to the Treasury Department or, you know, at tax time, what do they do with that? Where does that go? Because it's not paying down any debt for them.
You haven't been paying attention. You know where it goes. It's wealth redistribution. It goes to pay for the food stamps and the welfare programs and Social Security benefits and all these other entitlement programs that they built up over the decades.
Well,
it's robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Right. Then how do the banks make the money? I mean, don't they plunder from that too? Or is that the Congress? I don't.
My dear. Okay. Let's back up and do a little bit of math, shall we?
Okay.
So I want you to write down some figures, because I want you to go look these up. And they change, so my information is years old, and I'm sure it's changed some. If you look at the total defense spending for the United States, okay? Because isn't that one of the sacred cows? We can't cut defense spending, okay? What I want you to do is I want you to take corporate income tax. Write down corporate income tax.
Okay.
Then I want you to go online and I want you to research how much money the federal government collected in corporate taxes last year. And then write that number down. And then right below it, I want you to write defense spending. And then go Google that and figure out how much we spent on defense last year and write that number down. And I think you're going to see a correlation between those two.
Oh, wow.
Because if they're not exactly to the penny the same, I'd be surprised. Now you go over to the next category.
Okay.
Total individual income tax revenue collected. Okay?
Okay.
And you'll see something here. What I can tell you is the federal government last fiscal year collected $2.7 trillion in taxes.
Is that from the individuals?
Total.
Oh.
Okay. The total expenditures of government last year was $3.6 trillion. Okay? So this is where they start talking about budget. Oh, we got a budget shortfall. Yes, yes, yes. Well, that means that you borrowed $1.6 trillion. Now, what's not included in that figure? Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Not in there.
Oh, my God.
Because those are off budget. See, because they don't want you to understand what a fiasco that is. So those are off budget. And that's when they talk about, well, they took Social Security out of the lockbox. That means that they put it on budget. They put it on as a budgetary item. And then they took it off again. And then they put it on again. This is shenanigans they play with the numbers, right? Because they don't.
Oh my
now
gosh.
You see it, now you don't. It's like Mandrake the frickin' magician.
So
the
where
fact
does
of the matter
is, right. I'm just wondering how these banksters, the central cartels, how do they make their money if it's, I mean, somewhere it's got to come from. So I know
sure.
It's book entries, but there's
got
to be
interest payment. They get interest
payments. Who's
paying
the interest? Who pays the interest? That's, I guess, my question.
Well, presumably, the federal government. And where do they get the money? You and I. So, again,
okay.
We're going back to this thing. Ron Paul said something when they were when they were talking about, you know, aid to Egypt and aid to Israel and aid to all these other countries. And they said, oh, well, it's segregated funds and it's not being used for any military purpose. And he looked at him and he said, well, you can say that. But the reality is that all funds are fungible. And what that means, fungible, is interchangeable. Okay?
Sure.
So we give Egypt $12 billion and say, now you can't use it for any nefarious purposes. And they say, oh, no problem. We're going to put it in the widow and orphan fund over here.
Yeah.
And we're going to spend this money on widows and orphans. But the reality is, even if they spend it on widows and orphans, that's $12 billion freed up from their own revenues that they can spend on evil and nefarious things. Right?
Right. That would be like having a sugar daddy in your own. Yeah.
Right. It's left pocket, right pocket scenario. It really doesn't damn matter what you call it, what label you put on it. So
the government
spending, you know, $3.8 trillion or $4.2 trillion, and it's only collecting $2.7. So how do we have this deficit spending? We borrow the money. Well, how do we borrow the money? Well, we get it at damn near 0% interest, see? So we borrow the money, and we use that extra money to fill the gaps. Now, revenue, it's not a static thing. It's not as if that every April 15th all this money comes flowing in the government and then they dole it out. No, it's a constant thing, day in and day out.
Right.
It's a constantly evolving thing. So as that money flows in, they allocate portions of it to go over to service the debt. It's like having a credit card, and the minimum payment is due on the 30th, and you just took in some money, and you got just enough to cover the minimum payment, no problem. But now that I've covered the minimum payment, well, crap, I don't have enough money to cover the Social Security. You go back to the bank, the Fed, and you borrow the money, and you pay the Social Security payments, and then the next month, well, what do? You got to, geez, here comes that revenue coming in. We're going to divert this over to pay the interest on the money we just borrowed. And then it's a vicious cycle. And see, what we used to have decades ago, way back when, government debt matured at a rate of, you know, 10, 20 years. You got 10-year treasuries, 20-year treasuries.
Uh-huh.
Hell, they had 30-year treasuries, right? But currently what you're seeing now is the amount of time to maturity is getting shorter and shorter and shorter.
Oh, yeah.
So instead of the maturity date being 10 years in the future or 5 years in the future or even 1 year in the future, it's 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. Gee, that sounds a lot like somebody running off credit cards where you're using one card to pay the other one and they're all 30 days behind and you're running this cycle. And pretty soon you end up like a damn hamster on a wheel, which is exactly where we're at. And at some point, the bearings are going to give out because the wheel is smoking. I'm here to tell you. It is hauling the mail. And the little hamsters, that's you and me, we're all down there just, you know, we're about exhausted.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, I think that's one of the questions FT was talking about, you know, with the monetary system. And I tried to explain to him in the chat room that if, because he talked about education, waking people up, and I went, well, if we had even 30% of the people knowing what these people are doing to them and how long it's been going on, there'd be a revolution by tomorrow morning. But
you sound like Henry Ford now.
Absolutely.
I want to welcome Luke into the chat room. Yeah,
all right, he finally got in.
Yeah, that was Henry Ford, because, you know, Henry Ford, even though in all the literature and all the crap, you know, he got to finally get up there and rebel those with the boys, and he's been accused of being a philanthropic Jew and all this other crap. The fact of the matter is, Henry Ford was a little guy, and he fought to get his idea
right
where he could, you know, sell it commercially, and he fought uphill the Detroit Motor Club.
Wow.
And the whole gang, and he finally got it approved. And he's the one that, once he recognized how the banking industry worked, he's the one that came out with that. He said, if the American people ever knew how the banking system actually works, there would be a revolution by morning. He was absolutely correct.
That's true. It's a shame they didn't wake up back.
Yeah, and you look at what has been stolen from the American people. And you know, I got another tidbit that I want to share with you. I shared this with Mikey B after hours on his show the other day. But I got to thinking about it, and it just makes too much sense. And I hate to demonize poor old Abe. I mean, honest Abe, you know, I've given him a hard rap. But you know, we talk about the monetary system as it exists today. And we know what went on early on with the First National Bank and then the Second National Bank of the United States, the one that Andrew Jackson defeated. But there was something else that almost went unnoticed by even yours truly, and that was what happened during the Civil War in 1863.
Okay.
The National Banking Act.
Oh, wow.
Without the National Banking Act, the Federal Reserve Act would not have been possible.
Oh, wow.
You know, we talk about communism, right? Socialism. Hugo Chavez, and he nationalized everything over in Venezuela.
Yep.
And what a dirty bastard. Well, you know what? Your Congress, ladies and gentlemen, your United States Congress, with the complicit instruction from Honest Abe Lincoln, nationalized the banking system in the United States of America in 1863 under the National Banking Act.
Yeah, we got sold down the river a long, long time ago. And then, what was it, the act of 1871 where they sold out to the Rothschilds because the Civil War was too expensive, bastard.
Well, you see, and I mean, there's a story that behind the National Banking Act that allegedly Lincoln was, and I don't believe it was alleged, I believe it is true, that the bankers were demanding, you know, 34% interest or 24% interest Lincoln the money to prosecute the war against the South. Meanwhile, the South was also getting loans from the Bank of England to prosecute the war against the North and the War of Northern Aggression, right? So, of course, nothing new here. We're funding both sides of the war. Well, Lincoln said that shit ain't going to fly. And one of his advisors told him, well, do what the bank does. Print your own damn money. And he did.
Oh, and then he wanted the greenbacks. And they got rid of it.
Thank you. And in order to make that work, we had to have the National Banking Act that nationalized banks, because we had all these state banks that were printing state banknotes, you know, or their own banknotes. You know, I've got some of them, actually. My wife bought some when we were in Louisiana, some
cool
Georgia and Alabama banknotes, state banknotes. Well, you know, they really put the hammer on the state banks and tried to force all the banks to nationalize. Many of them just went bankrupt.
Oh, my God.
Because this new banking system had the power and weight and authority of the federal government behind it. But there were some state banks that were still very solvent because they engaged in honest banking practices.
You
know, that's difficult for me to even say, by the way. Honest banking practices. So what the government did was they passed a tariff or a tax on all private issued banknotes of 80%.
Jesus. Schmendrick.
So if you had a State Bank of Georgia $1 note, well, it was worth 20 frickin' cents. Well, you know how long that was going to last.
Yeah, sure.
Not very. I mean, you'd have to be an idiot to do something like that, to take that money at par with a greenback or a silver dollar or a gold coin, which,
sure,
by the way, still were in circulation. Gold and silver coins were still circulating, and it was still legal tender, and they didn't outlaw owning it. But that was the camel's nose under the tent, so to speak.
Sure.
That allowed for the Federal Reserve System to be born. And it was just a way to hypothecate money to finance deficit spending by the federal government to prosecute a war against those nasty-ass states in the South that wanted states' rights.
God. I know. It's crazy.
Isn't it great?
I know.
The monetary history of the United States is the most fascinating thing to me. When you see it in action and you actually begin to understand how it all correlates together, it's amazing.
And the other thing is what happens, you know, there's human events that push a lot of this stuff. And, of course, there's manipulation by some.
Oh, sure, you've got to look at the whole picture. You can't look
at
just
the
small minutia. But to me, when you look at it, and that's what I was telling Ted, regardless of how you slice it, the centerpiece for every single destruction of civilization has been the banking system, the monetary system.
Yep, Rome did it
exactly. Every civilization has done it. It is the single mechanism that allows you to infect the hearts and minds and put into servitude every individual within the system, in the country. Because, as Ms. Barnhart correctly points out, money is nothing but a fungible proxy for your time.
A medium of exchange,
energy, and effort. If we can ever get to the point where we stop looking at where we don't see dollars, and we see man hours, my productive time. How long does it take me to make a cheeseburger, okay?
Yeah.
If we can ever get to that point, then we'll stop looking at, gold's $1,300 an ounce, and we'll start focusing on the ratio. We'll start focusing on the ratio between gold and silver, or the ratio between silver and cheeseburgers, or silver and, you know, clothes,
or
Jack
Daniels
paper dollars.
Shoes.
Right. It's all relative. It's all a representative of your time.
I know. I'm going to let you wrap it up because I think you're running out of time. Are you?
I am running out of time on that note. No pun intended.
Okay. Thanks for taking the call, and I'm going to go hang out in the chat room. God bless, and see you tomorrow.
God bless you. Thank you for calling in. I want to thank everyone for tuning in, and I'm going to give you a rundown of our shows. Guys, just keep plugging, keep your head up, and be prepared. Be prepared, because bad things are coming.
Blog Talk. Blog Talk Radio and Patriot Family is where you need to be if you want to be informed and inspired 5 days a week. On Monday at 7:30 p.m., you can listen to the Constitution Hour. On Tuesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Family Chat. On Wednesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Right from the Left Coast. On Thursday at 6 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Education. And on Friday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Exposed but Never Forgotten. All times are Eastern Standard Time. Hope to see you there.